quote, "Capitalism is the supreme expression of human creativity and freedom." Today on Uncommon Knowledge, George Gilder, author of Wealth and Poverty, the book that became a bestseller during the first year of the Reagan years and a guide to the Reagan administration itself, and now, just in time perhaps for the Romney years, is available in a new edition. George Gilder on Uncommon Knowledge, now. Welcome to Uncommon Knowledge. I'm Peter Robinson. Be sure to visit us on our website at hoover.org/UK or on Facebook at facebook.com/UNCKnowledge. Facebook.com/UNCKknowledge. Born in New York City, George Gilder grew up on a dairy farm in western Massachusetts. After graduating from Harvard and serving in the Marines, he became a speechwriter, working for Richard Nixon, Bob Dole, Nelson Rockefeller, and George Romney. Mr. Gilder is now a senior fellow at the Discovery Institute and the editor-in-chief of the Gilder Technology Report. Spanning the gamut from politics to economics to technology, George Gilder's 15 books include Men and Marriage, Telecosm, and The Israel Test. An updated version of his 1981 classic, Mr. Gilder's newest book is Wealth and Poverty, a New Edition for the 21st Century. George, welcome.
Great to be here, Peter.
I can attest, by the way, I have still somewhere on my bookshelf my dog-eared paperback, which was all I could afford when I was a speechwriter in the Reagan years, of the original Wealth and Poverty. Segment one, Capitalism. From the prologue to this book, quote, "Back during the tempestuous years of the 1970s, with President Jimmy Carter waving limp white flags of national malaise, with hostages still held in Tehran, with the Soviet Union battening rich on oil wealth, and economist John Kenneth Galbraith acclaiming the fast growth of the Soviet economy, I, George Gilder, declared that socialism was dead." What did you see that John Kenneth Galbraith didn't see?
I saw the Soviet Union was not a success, that China under Mao was not a success. They were the most monstrous regimes in history, and that Sweden was struggling hopelessly. Their tax rates had risen to 106% on Ingmar Bergman, their leading a film director, and Bjorn Borg had moved to Malta or somewhere
Monte
to
Carlo
escape,
anywhere out,
wherever
right.
It was, to escape high tax rates. And S.R. Lindbeck, who was head of the Nobel Economics Prize Committee, was writing trenchant critiques of the Swedish welfare state, showed how the destruction of the family created burdens on government that could not possibly be met, that it was a spiral of decline that was initiated by family breakdown. And I'd written two books about family breakdown, and so I was ready to adopt these insights and adapt them to the predicament of the U.S. under Jimmy Carter.
Now, you just said that you saw socialism didn't work. And in Wealth and Poverty, let's say it's the weak form of your argument that capitalism does work. But you go much beyond that to make the strong form of the argument is not only does capitalism work, but, quote, "Capitalism was not simply a practical success. It is the supreme expression of human creativity," close quote. That, by the way, as I recall back in the 80s when this first came out, that was what stuck in the craw of the John Kenneth Galbraiths of the world. And even, frankly, some people who are well-disposed toward capitalism. It's one matter to say that free markets are an efficient way of allocating capital and labor. It's another to say that it is a moral good. And yet you insisted on just that. Why?
Because I thought that Ayn Rand was in big influence on me, as she was on Paul Ryan, right. and Ayn Rand devoted her last speech at the Ford Hall Forum in Cambridge to attacking wealth and poverty and its thesis that capitalism was ultimately altruistic. And it seems to me that this is precisely true, that capitalists, when you consider them, they have to begin with an imaginative response to the needs of others. They have to forego their own consumption and save in order to assemble resources to deploy for a process, the outcome of which is determined not by themselves, but as Peter Drucker identified.
The great management guru.
Yeah, the great management guru saw that companies are dependent on customers and investors, and neither of them are under the control of the entrepreneur himself. The entrepreneur has to collaborate with others. The entrepreneur follows the golden rule. He wants others to succeed. Any business is completely dependent on the successes of all the other businesses around them. It seemed to me to be quite obtuse to say that capitalism is based on selfishness or greed.
Greed.
Greed, as I said, in Wealth and Poverty, focusing on what greedy people actually do. What do greedy people do? They seek comfort and security first. They collaborate with government to get special privileges and seats at the trough. We've seen a lot of greed in the crony capitalism of the last several years that brought down the global economy. Greed leads us by an invisible hand to an ever-growing welfare state, to socialism, not to capitalism.
You're sticking in, I can hear people's craws getting stuck all over again listening to this. Segment two, what Reagan wrought. Your book comes out, the original edition of Wealth and Poverty comes out in 1981, Ronald Reagan's first year. It was widely read in the administration, and I know because I was there. In a recent editorial in the Wall Street Journal, you wrote about Reagan's defense buildup and tax cuts as two efforts to promote capitalism. Let's take them each. Quote, quoting you now, Reagan's near-trillion-dollar bulge in defense spending transformed the global balance of power in favor of capitalism, close quote. Explain that.
Well, it brought the end to the Cold War. It dissolved the Berlin Wall, which unleashed all the Eastern European countries to rise up and have more thriving capitalist economies today than Western Europe does in its socialist stagnation. And it precipitated radical changes in China and India.
Your reading of China, we're told over and over again that Deng Xiaoping, it was 1970 year, was the crucial year of departure for China. That's the year when Deng said, began to open to markets, which of course preceded Ronald Reagan and the victory over the Soviet Union in the Cold War. But what effect do you reckon those Reagan years and the collapse of the Soviet Union had on China?
I think it precipitated the Chinese turn to capitalism. I said back when I visited China, I think in 1988, they asked me what was going to happen in 1997 when
the British treaty in Hong Kong ran out.
Yeah, that's right. And I said, that's the year that Hong Kong will begin taking over China. And I think that's exactly right. That's exactly what happened. Deng followed the model of Hong Kong, creating free zones all up and down the coast of China and creating this wonderful dynamic where everybody outside the free zones wants to move into the free zones. And the people in the free zones want them expanded. And so you have a dynamic that favors the development of freedom. If you try to impose freedom from the center, perestroika, as the Russians tried to do, you incur the resistance of all the forces that benefit from the old order.
I see.
And that's why freedom took off in China and actually was frustrated to a great extent in Russia.
Back to Reagan and the defense buildup. What we hear these days a lot is balance the budget. Clinton balanced the budget. The great hero is Clinton, who balanced the budget. And Reagan's defense buildup blew a hole in the budget, which by the standards of those days, by the standards of what Barack Obama's done since, the hole was this big. But by the standards of those days, it seemed vast. Yeah. This is indefensible, isn't it, this deficit spending to engage in a defense buildup under Reagan?
Well, my belief is that, I came from wealth and poverty sprung from the Carter years. And Carter balanced the budget. Carter had a trade surplus. Carter, by the measure of the accountant economists who want to preoccupy themselves with debt, with American liabilities rather than American assets, was a big success. But the Carter administration, in fact, ran an economy where the government was in the black, but everybody else was in the red. Reagan, pursuing opportunities rather than solving problems, challenged the Soviet Union, opened the world to capitalism, and unleashed a $17 trillion buildup in American assets that, after he left office, ultimately flowered into a $60 trillion growth of American assets. So the private sector thrived. The people thrived. The government suffered some austerity under Reagan.
Quoting you once again, George, spurring a stock market, energy, venture capital, real estate, and employment boom, the Reagan tax cuts and other pro-enterprise policies added some $17 trillion to America's private sector assets, close quote. Okay. Now, Reagan's running a budget deficit. Why wasn't that? Excuse me, let me back up. I can remember an event. This won't surprise you, although I don't think I've ever told you about this before. But not long after I joined the speechwriting staff, I found myself in the West Wing office of David Gergen, now at the Harvard Kennedy School, then the director of communications in the Reagan White House. And Gergen was talking about economics, and he said, well, of course we can't say this in public, but you understand that President Reagan is engaging in a perfectly orthodox Keynesian stimulus. Mm. Why was David Gergen wrong about that? Why is Paul Krugman wrong that we need more Keynesian stimulus now?
Yeah. Because, first of all, Reagan crucially cut tax rates by 25% across the board. And as and the result of this was not less revenues. It was a big surge of revenues, some 60% growth in revenues ultimately during the course of the Reagan years. The whole Keynesian model, I think, fails because it's based on demand. And demand is homogeneous and meaningless. While all economic growth comes from human creativity that always comes as a surprise to us and thus cannot be demanded. It doesn't matter how many dollars there are in people's pockets. It's the ideas in people's heads that make the economies thrive. And if you suppress and crimp and restrict the creativity of entrepreneurs, you can't have a thriving economy regardless of how much government spending is performed or how many dollars are printed.
All right. So your contention, I want to move on from the Reagan years, but I'd like to nail this down first. You contend that Ronald Reagan cutting taxes, other pro-growth policies, sets in place an economic boom that continues for a quarter of a century. Mm. It's fundamentally the Reagan expansion. Mm. All right. Bill Clinton says, oh, no, 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 no. I, Bill Clinton, am responsible for the boom of the 1990s. And by the way, I raised the top income tax rate to 39%. George answers that how?
Well, he raised it to a level that was substantially below what the level was when
Reagan started at 70.
But he also cut capital gains taxes by 20%. And capital gains taxes are a peculiarly fertile capital gains tax cuts are a peculiarly fertile form of policy. And they directly address the growth of assets. And indeed, all the increasing revenues that were harvested during the Clinton years came from the capital gains tax cut rather than
Bill Clinton balanced the budget because he cut taxes.
He cut tax rates.
All right. Segment three, what went wrong? In 2008, quarter-century boom ends in a financial collapse, wealth and poverty. Quote, quoting you, there is no doubt that the egregious events of the mid-2000s pose dire questions, close quote. Well, the most dire question is, what happened? What went wrong? The market failed, I guess.
What happened was a real capitulation to the whole finance sector by the Bush administration at the end, and allowing Paulson, the former head of Goldman Sachs, to run our policy in favor of Wall Street during the midst of a general economic tumble, and launch TARP and all these this erratic power grabs and crony connections, and it was just an orgy of crony capitalism that we saw in the years leading up to the 2008, focused on this housing fetish that both parties adopted to a great extent.
Former Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan testifying in 2008 as the crisis is taking place, quote, the crisis has turned out to be broader than anything I could have imagined. You talked about Ayn Rand earlier. Yeah. Ayn Rand was a big influence on Alan Greenspan, who knew her well. Those of us, Alan Greenspan continues, those of us who looked to the self-interest of the leading institutions to protect shareholders' equity, including me, Alan Greenspan, are in a state of shocked disbelief, close quote. Highly paid bankers who had a lot at risk and a lot to gain somehow failed in the most elementary duties of competence. Why? Why isn't that a failure of capitalism?
It's a failure of these bankers and their orientation toward Washington and their capitulation to these requirements that they issue loans to, you know,
people who
subprime, the whole subprime development. It was really the usurpation of crony capitalism of real capitalism, and it ultimately failed. I mean, it was the whole, the other problem. There is a kind of hypertrophy of finance, which really
leading into the 2008 crisis?
It was, 30% of all the profits in the economy were coming from finance. And this was really an effect of floating currencies and erratic economic leadership from the world financial establishment. I mean, Basel Group, was requiring purchase of the very subprime mortgages and sovereign debt that were at the heart of the crisis.
And
and the United States. And Barney Frank and Chris Dodd were vehement advocates of the impregnability of Fannie and Freddie that were crucial forces in creating this catastrophe.
Wealth and poverty, quote, on the wrong side of the trade. The financial trades taking place in 2008, the buyers of bad mortgages and filigreed bonds were most of the world's central banks, the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, Citicorp, Merrill Lynch, Deutsche Bank, and Bank of America. All commanded easy access to government funding and safety nets. In the great banks, any actual knowledge of the details of the securities they held and the risks they ran was entirely divorced from the administrative and bureaucratic power at the top, close quote. So somehow or other, I put it to you to see if I've got it right. The financial crisis of 2008 is not a failure of capitalism, but of some kind of sclerotic, symbiotic, and basically in one way or another corrupt establishment of big finance and big government.
That's what I think.
And so we should have just let them all go down? Bear Stearns should have been permitted to go down. Yeah, it was they let Lehman go down.
And their assets would have been redeployed in better ways, and the economy would have recovered a lot quicker, as we have much experience over the years of economies turning around quickly when the crucial afflicted parts of them fail. You know, from the 1920-21 crash that Harding turned around and by just refusal to accommodate the forces of that caused it. And the post-World War II was, according to the Keynesians, was going to be the biggest crisis that of dislocation and unemployment that any economy had ever faced. These are the words of Paul Samuelson. Mm-hmm. Instead, the economy roared out of the Second World War after a 60% drop in government spending and dismantling the whole wartime apparatus of controls, surprisingly enough, did not lead to unemployment. It unleashed entrepreneurial forces that produced a 10-year boom. And this is just experience all around the world, which I discuss in The New Wealth and Poverty, that shows how fast countries can turn around if they retrench government, reduce tax rates rather than prop up the past in the name of progress, which is the usual government pursuit.
Segment four, the Reagan lesson for Romney and Ryan. This is you, George, writing recently in the Wall Street Journal. Quote, everyone knows about America's budget liabilities, but the real opportunity, not to fix them, the real opportunity is to transcend them by reversing the devaluation of America's human and capital assets. Close quote. First, what do you mean by that term, the devaluation of our assets, both human and capital?
I think it comes from policy, that, you know, the implication of the accountant economists, as I call them, who appraise our problem as chiefly a crisis of debt, is that all these policies that the Obama administration has been pursuing, all this litigation, all these amazing mazes of new rules,
Dodd-Frank,
Sarbanes-Oxley, the whole mass of federal regulations, the subsidies and requirements of green enterprise that have sicklied over our venture capital community with a pale cast of green goo, and we have dreadful oppressive policies in place, the removal of those policies can unleash a new revival of American assets. And it's really the collapse of the value of American assets, from the dollar to the venture community, to the banks, to our energy resources, which are struggling to fight free of the EPA's general clamp on all new energy production. And all these policies are what devalue America's assets. Under the Reagan administration, he actually increased the deficit, but America's assets soared. I think that can happen again. We do have to get the darn entitlements in order, but that's an opportunity, really. People are being driven out of the workforce. That's a mistake. People are living 20 years longer than when Social Security was formed. Old people can contribute to the economy, be assets rather than liabilities, who are forced by government policy, really, to retire at age 60 or 65 or with all these public pension programs even earlier.
Now, George, you've said you've drawn this distinction implicitly, I think, but let me just state it to see if I understand you correctly. It's not how much the federal government borrows. It's not the size of the deficit per se. it's the rate of return the nation gets from the borrowed money that matters.
That's
Reagan increased the deficit, but the rate of return, won the Cold War, and our asset stock went up 17 times or some huge number like that during his own time in office. That's correct?
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay, so what you would say to Reagan, I beg your pardon, to Romney and Ryan is, fine, you have to worry about the budget. But that's about item two or three on your list, on your to-do list. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Item one on their to-do list.
Item one on the to-do list is simplifying the tax code, reducing tax rates, and removing regulations that are paralyzing the economy. Mansur Olson, you know, wrote a book called The Rise and Decline of Nations, which said that at a certain point, democratic countries become encrusted and paralyzed by their accretions of regulation and special interest subsidies and layers and layers of laws that often conflict, fees, tax rates,
Every so often, you have to put the vessel in dry dock and scrape the barnacles off the hull.
That's right.
And we ought to expect that.
And Canada did it. Canada reduced its government spending from 17%, 17.5% of GDP to 11%. New Zealand did it. Israel did it. All the successful economies of the recent years have actually had a moment when they cleared away the incredible multiple sclerosis
President Obama at the Democratic Convention, who thought he was talking to the delegates and the nation, when in fact he was answering George Gilder. A clip.
All they have to offer is the same prescriptions they've had for the last 30 years. Have a surplus? Try a tax cut. Deficit too high? Try another. Feel a cold coming on? Take two tax cuts, roll back some regulations, and call us in the morning.
So, George, you're just advocating same old, same old.
I am. It's that's the point of republishing Wealth and Poverty for this new era. These people have forgotten it. They deride us for saying that lower tax rates yield more revenues. The current Obama administration actually argues that not that tax cuts pay for themselves, but government spending automatically pays for itself. But nothing works except entrepreneurial invention and creativity. And removing the hobbles and restrictions on enterprise is absolutely critical to American success in the next era.
Obamacare, wealth and poverty. Quote, there are only two ways to manage health care. One is to allow the government to ration care. The other is to give citizens the right to make choices about their own care, period. Should Governor Romney insist on a total repeal of Obamacare?
I think so. I think that would be galvanic and enormously beneficial for the health care industry, which shouldn't be identified with the current incrustation of declining institutions and paralyzed kinds of bureaucracies. Healthcare should be creating American assets rather than depleting the American treasury. Healthcare creates healthy citizens who can participate successfully in the economy and society. And it's an asset. And its reform is all upside. It's not a burden that imposes some impossible a challenge to the of debt and liabilities.
All right. Segment five, the 1%. The political attack on your point of view, even in the form in which I think it's fair to say the relatively modest form in which it's being advocated by the Republicans right now, you know the attack. It's tax cuts for millionaires and billionaires. It's benefits for the 1%. Wealth and poverty. Quote, America's entrepreneurs, and you take this question straight on, America's entrepreneurs live in a world with 4 billion poor people. Why on a planet riven with famine, poverty, and disease should this tiny minority be allowed to control riches thousands of times greater than they need for subsistence and comfort? Close quote. And you answer that question how?
I answer that question that it's a tiny minority of people who are really responsible for all our wealth and our opportunities. And I recently wrote a book called The Israel Test that identified one particular group of them, Jews, in America and around the world have hugely outproduced their own numbers and have made absolutely vital contributions to global welfare and prosperity. And it's the entrepreneurs of America are precious. And they change. This doesn't mean we support any particular cohort of entrepreneurs. It doesn't mean we enshrine them in Washington and give them special privileges, which is what Obama's idea is. He takes all the people who are mostly responsible for the financial crash and puts them in the Treasury and exalts them and exalts their powers. He subsidizes the green entrepreneurs and sicklies them. Entrepreneurial capitalism works because it's always surprising which people are going to actually create the crucial innovations that unleash wealth and opportunity. And if you prejudge it and if you try to capture the yields and redistribute them by government, the whole process is stifled.
So, all right. This notion that in some fundamental way it's just wrong on the face of it for people, some to have billions while others are struggling. And you write as follows. I was struck by this quotation, again in Wealth and Poverty. Far from being greedy, America's leading entrepreneurs, we might as well simply rewrite that, billionaires, not all of them, but the ones who've made their own money, cannot revel in their wealth. They cannot revel in their wealth because most of it isn't liquid. Yeah. It's been given to others in the form of investments. The reason capitalism works is that the creators of wealth are granted the right and burden of reinvesting it.
That's absolutely critical. That's the critical point. Capitalists can only keep what they give away, what they invest, what they assign to others, what they commit to a process of service to the world. And that's the secret of capitalist success, that the same people who prove by previous entrepreneurial experiments that they're capable of creating wealth get to control the next phase of investment. The socialist wants to benefit from the entrepreneur's success and then take the capital away and deploy it for some government purpose. But that thwarts the information process that is which is actually critical the success of any economy. It's dependent on creativity, which always comes as a surprise to us.
I'm trying to anticipate the criticisms in the faculty lounge at your alma mater, Harvard. And one we've already discussed, that somehow it's just on the face of it. John Kenneth Galbraith said that he liked to be able to imagine that in the night he could hear the screams of the rich. Just as an aesthetic matter, some people have too much. That was the point. But there's also the matter that some of them do revel in their wealth, and some of them are quite vulgar about it. Nobody needs a G5. And look at the way down. So your argument is, sorry, if you want economic growth, you must suffer Donald Trump.
Yes. I mean, you must. You must. But the fact is that this reveling in their wealth that is depicted in all the magazines. It's a preoccupation.
Lifestyles of the rich and famous.
Yeah, it's Hollywood. It's athletes. It's people who, it's lottery winners of various kinds. It's, the actual rich are mostly very sober, productive, engaged in their business. And reinvesting the yields of their enterprise. And it's the process of reinvesting the yields of enterprise that's the secret of capitalist success. The same people who invent the new products get to control who commands the profits. And profits are surprising. I think the interest rate captures the predictable returns across an economy. Its profits are the unexpected returns, and on the downside, the unexpected failures. And you have to allow the people who generate the profits or the losses to benefit from the successes and pay for the failures. If you thwart that process, wealth creation stops.
George, the original edition of Wealth and Poverty, 1981, Ronald Reagan's administration, broadly speaking, enacted this agenda. 25 years, as you've just argued, of economic expansion. Why do we have a president who in his 4 years in office, if the lessons of the past 25 years were the lessons that you have argued, who has expanded the government into healthcare, into the auto industry, into energy, why is it that you need to bring out a new edition of Wealth and Poverty in 2012? Why does the American democracy, why don't we learn?
Yeah, it's hard to learn. I think we are learning. But the big threat is a political party that's based on creating dependency and essentially paralyzing the potential of our society. And one of the things Wealth and Poverty predicted was that if the family collapses, it will take a welfare state to care for the women and children, and a police state to handle the boys. And that's what this dependency engine has wrought. It is a third of all young black men are in jail or on probation or on the lam. The failure of the welfare state cannot be exaggerated. And the biggest victims were its most cherished clients, which were the inner city. The inner city was the test, and it was the location of its most catastrophic and obvious failure. And so the big irony is that you have Barack Obama, the first black president, devoted to extending the tentacles of this welfare state, which is a new plantation enslaving a whole generation of blacks.
If you could offer one sentence of advice to Mitt Romney for these 50-some remaining days between now and the election, what would you say?
Be confident about your capitalism. You know, your time at Bain & Company was a heroic success. It participated in a great restructuring of the economy that yielded some 45 million new jobs during that phase. Michael Jensen studied the effects of this.
Harvard Business School professor.
Studied the effects with us, and of 43,000 merger and acquisition operations during this period, and showed that they dramatically spurred employment, increased asset values, spurred research and development, enriched communities, and made the U.S. dominant in the world economy. Romney should be confident in this and laugh at people who try to captiously focus on one or two anecdotes of failure at Bain. Of course, Bain failed a lot of the time. It was addressing companies that needed to be turned around, and turnarounds are often difficult. But the overwhelming success of the movement that Romney led is an inspiring precursor for a revitalization of America under Romney and Ryan over the next several years.
George Gilder, author of Wealth and Poverty, a new edition for the 21st century. George, I'd like you to close, if you would, please, simply by reading a passage from this book.
The belief that wealth consists not in ideas, attitudes, moral codes, and mental disciplines, but in definable and static things that can be seized and redistributed is the materialist superstition. It stultified the works of Marx. It betrays every person who seeks to redistribute wealth by coercion. The means of production of entrepreneurs are not land, labor, and capital, all the things that the accountant economists add up, but minds and hearts. Capitalism begins not with taking, but with giving.
George Gilder, thank you very much.
Thank you.
For Uncommon Knowledge, I'm Peter Robinson.